Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. There's a weekly talk tomorrow, I think, in the where we're going to see actually the technical details that I omitted.
Sorry, we should have that more clearly. Sorry, that was it. But David has agreed to sort of keep the technical details to a minimum here and give a clean talk of general interest. But those people who are interested in technical details will be getting together again here in this room at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning for a more informal discussion.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, David.
Well, that's okay. So the idea is that tomorrow we can keep being honest.
I got
you
today?
No, there's a few things. I'm going to tell you where I am being a little bit blasé or excessively optimistic on how far you can push the calculations. The outline of the talk, this is really about ideas here. So I'm going to be talking about how, in some sense, we've got about trying to prove the ideas here, the correspondence, and what do we know about it. And how if we start with the conformal theory, we can say a whole bunch of wonderful things about gravity in the center space. And the question is, how do we make this work? So I'm going to talk a little bit about this stuff, about how you can see what we call quantum hole droplets as some effective description of part of the ABS CFT program. How you will describe them in gravity. And then I'm going to go beyond this very, very supersymmetric sector and tell you how you're supposed to think about the rest of the supergravity. And I'm going to talk a little bit about why I think this is the correct way to go about proving the ABS-CFT if you want to name it that way. What happened?
No, we'll
look at
our hockey stick,
the funny part. Yeah, it's
important.
We'll get one. By next week, sorry. So I have to do it in my hands. There'll be a lot of gesturing. So I'm not going to tell you the idea of CFT correspondence. I'm just going to tell you that it's something that's out there. It's a conjecture. It was conjectured by Albert Hennen a couple of years ago. So the ABS-CFT correspondence is a conjecture of exact quantum duality between n equal 4 supersymmetric angles theory on a sphere times time. So this is where you do field theory on a compact volume. And type 2B superstring theory as a theory of gravity on areas 5 versus 5. So this is my cartoon of the sphere and time, and this is my cartoon of ABS-5 and BS-5, and this is ABS-5 as seeing global coordinates. So this is why it has this sort of potential realm structure. So the idea is that these two quantum systems, which look very different from each other at the classical level, are indeed equivalent at the quantum level. And one would like to understand how does this work. So the past years, we've had a lot of reasons why the correspondence should work. Meaning we have a lot of circumstantial evidence overwhelmingly, so that makes me believe that this is actually a true statement. The question is not anymore why this should happen. The really big question is how does it happen? How do we really relate these two systems and derive one from the other one, so to speak? And this is the objective of this talk. And I'm going to be more precise because I'm going to start with the field theory. So if I start with the field theory, the big question you have to ask is where does geometry come from? If you answer that question, you can say something about the idea theory. So there's a couple of generalities that you need to have in mind. When you say that two systems are quantum equivalent, this means that you have an identification of the Hilbert space of states on both sides. So any state in the Daniels theory, there's a corresponding state in the alias sign and vice versa. This is not a very useful characterization of saying that two quantum systems are equivalent because most Hilbert spaces are identical to each other, at least the infinite dimensional ones. So what we really mean by a quantum system is quantum system together with some operators. And then one of the examples that you can think about is the superconformal algebra. So on both sides you have a superconformal algebra for supersymmetries, and you don't want to just have the same algebra, but you also want to identify the superconformal monomorphs and the representation theory of these algebra. And you want to make the identification of the states respecting this superconformal splitting of the Hilbert space. So this is an example of the type of stuff that one wants to do. So let me go a little bit now to coordinate system. I'm going to be working in the supergravity side on global coordinates. So in global coordinates, we have the metric of ADS5. The T over there is global time. And this global time has a gravitational potential, which is this function in front of it. And this gravitational potential, well, grows at infinity. So what you get is that the effective description is as you have plots on a box. So this is a problem of some gravitational potential, which grows at infinity. So you get a discrete spectrum. On the field theory side, you're on a round sphere. The round sphere is a compact geometry. Because the geometry is compact, you also expect a discrete spectrum. So we're going to study the spectrum with respect to the time associated to this time over here in ADS5. So that's a particular choice of time, and there's a Killing vector associated to it. And the Killing vector associated to that is the one that corresponds to the Hamiltonian evolution of the Young's theory in the time that we have identified. So
this is just an asymptotic Killing vector, right?
What?
This is an asymptotic Killing vector in the
Yes. Although if you stick to the pure supergravity solution, it is a Killing vector of this particular supergravity solution. It's always an asymptotic Killing vector, but on ADS5 it is an actual Killing vector. If you deform ADS5, it's only an asymptotic. Okay. So one of the few things is that the supergravity spectrum is known, and the supergravity multiplet in 10 dimensions, or the supergravity multiplet, is protected by supersymmetry in 5 dimensions. So all single particle graviton states belong to a supersymmetric representation of the superconformal group. What that means is that the representation theory is special. We call these states BPS. And this means it's protected by supersymmetry. So what we take this to mean is that we can compare with the free field theory limit. So when you have something which is protected by supersymmetry, usually does not depend on the coupling, and we can try to take the coupling to small coupling, and we can try to compare with the free field theory. So there's a little bit of representation theory that you have to trust me on this. The way you build representations of a superconformal group is you have to choose some highest weight state to a given representation. And then the rest of the representation is determined from the highest weight state by the usual relation. The highest weight Habibian states are really built out of only one of the scalar modes of one of the complex fields, the Lennikov Fourier minus, one of the scalar fields on, and let's call it Z. The point is that in the free field theory limit, I can describe everything in terms of free harmonic oscillators. And if I choose this particular field mode on the round S3, I'm choosing one particular set of harmonic oscillators of this gauge theory. And I'm going to use a complex basis for the oscillators so that the raising operator for the associated mode has the same letter as the mode, and the lowering operator is the derivative with respect to it. So this is just something that avoids a lot of trouble, and I can tell you what single graviton states are. So all single particle graviton states are descendants of a highest weight state, which is trace of Z to the N.
And dz is interpreted as this particular grading operator here. And this is the result of the work of Wittgen and also performing together. So basically, you start with this guy, you can build a full supergravity multiplet by acting with the supersymmetries. And the point is that the graviton states are going to be correlated with these particular sensor traces. So this is something that we need to have in mind. And this is part of the dictionary of the LDSCFT that I'm going to assume for my student talk. But this identification holds true, even strong coupling. So that's cheating a little bit, but there's a little bit of that anyhow, always. Now, once you discover the set of, let's say, perturbative supersymmetric states, you can always ask if there are other interesting BPS states in the theory. And you ask this question at the level of supergravity, and in supergravity, or at the level of the B-brains for string theory, Magridis, Asking, and Tomba found that there are some other objects in this theory of unempty center space which actually respect the same number of supersymmetries. And because of that, the representation theory content of these objects has to be the same as the one we have for gravitons. So a B3 brain, which wraps a 3 sphere inside the 5 sphere, and with some angular momentum on the 5 sphere, is actually a dynamically stable configuration of B brains that respects the same number of supersymmetries as these graviton states. And these were conjectured to resolve a technical issue that traces are not algebraically independent. You take an n-bind matrix and you take traces of that matrix to some high power, and eventually, when that power is bigger than n, then you get an overdetermined set of equations or states. So these objects were conjectured to resolve this technical problem. And they're objects which share the same properties as ordinary gravitons, except that they're big. So we call them giant gravitons. And this gives you the name. Well, it turns out that there's another giant graviton. And two groups discovered the second giant graviton. Hashimoto, Hirano, and Saki, and these are Myers and Flashboard. So this one is also BPS, but instead of growing into the phi sphere, it grows into the ADS five directions, and it also has some angular momentum on the phi sphere. So this object is also protected, and then you have to ask the question, is any one of these a trace? Is this the proper representation of these objects? We only understand them in the supergravity limit. The reason why traces were chosen to represent single particle states in the work of Witten, Grosser, Clement, and Polyakov is that for small quantum numbers, these sets of traces give an approximate description of a Fock space. And it's the identification of that Fock space with the Fock space of fluctuations of the gravity solutions on ADS 5 process 5 that you're identifying. Since this contains a lot of energy, the approximations that go into that Fock space have already broken down, and you really have to worry a little bit more carefully about that.
Isn't it a little bit overcounting to consider separately the point like graviton and the giant graviton? Because and there is a sense in which these are the same object.
We'll get to that pretty soon. I'll tell you what sense we're overcounting. The question is whether any one of these represents the trace. And the answer is no. So you have to call a dual operator for the dual states, the giants, and it turns out that neither is a trace. So we have to go back to the drawing board, and we need to look at all states that we serve the same number of supersymmetries. And then all of these half BPS states have to be descendants of not just single traces, but in principle multi-traces of these complex K2Z or that. And I'm going to lie here, not lie, but tell you a moral statement, it's not really an exact statement, is that when you have supersymmetric states, there are in some sense no quantum corrections to effective dynamics. And this is cheating because there can be corrections, but not necessarily to, to their energy, but they will manifest themselves in some other way. But in any case, these are no quantum corrections to effective dynamics. We can do the fitted limits. And what you get is just a set of n-binary matrices with a trace for bottom. And the Lagrangian for this set of matrices is just the ordinary Lagrangian for the harmonic oscillator. So I'm just going to assume that we get the weakly coupled effective dynamics for the time being and try to go from there and study the problem. So the dynamics that you get is a gauge dynamics. You have a gauge potential. It is metric quantum mechanics. The gauge potential is just a Lagrange multiplier. It acts as a constraint, but it does not give you new dynamical degrees of freedom. So all the degrees of freedom are really on these matrix Z. And on top of that, the number of degrees of freedom really reduces to the case of a single permission matrix model. But we have to work a little bit harder than that. So usually there's two ways to solve the system. The method one is you take axial gauge, meaning set the gauge field to zero. You have a system, which is this set of matrix quantum mechanics, which actually is a free matrix harmonic oscillator. So you can write all the states of the system and just quantize it. And then afterwards, you have to impose Gauss's law. You have to require that the state be engine back. So this is the way you recover the set of multi-traces. So the point is that you act with individual matrix components of Z as a raising operator, but then you have to make the state invariant under SRM gauge transformations. And that's basically what tells you that you have to contract upper indices with lower indices for a matrix multiplication. And that's what gives you these multi-traces. Yes?
Are you just a guess to say that this matrix
membership
governs all the
half-field states? Well, at the three-field theory limit, this is an exact statement. The question is whether this is true also at the level of strong coupling and equal Fourierian theory or not. So I'm going to skirt that question for afterwards. But the statement is that in the weak coupling limit, this is an exact statement. And then traces are algebraically independent of the order n. So the trace of z to the n plus 1 is a polynomial in lower traces. And these are the Cayley-Hamilton identities, Newton identities depending on what you want. And this basis is not orthogonal, it's only approximately orthogonal in the large n limit for fixed energy. So if I keep these letters fixed, the numbers over here, the energy fixed, and take n to infinity, then the system becomes asymptotically orthogonal. There's a more complicated way to make gauge invariant states, which is by using fancier ways to take traces. And this is just think of a trace as a character of UN, and think of the matrix Z as a generic n-binary matrix. So I can take the character of Z in various different representations, and the label R is over all the irreducibles of UN. And if you count things in terms of traces in these different representations, then the energy is the number of blocks is Young-Tan law, and this actually gives you a complete orthogonal basis for the problem. And then the conjecture is that the giant gravitons have drawn the pi sphere are what we call columns over here. So the columns have finite depth, and the giant gravitons that drawn to the S5 have a maximum size. So you'll make that identification. And Rangoulam set by symmetry of the Young-Tan law, the other giants, the ones who turn to ADS, should be those. So this is a fancy way to tell you that all these states are related to one another. It's just that different classical limits correspond to either having one very long row or a very long column or something like that. There's a second method to solve the problem. And it's to use the gauge transformation first. So now you choose a gauge where the matrix Z is diagonal. You write everything in terms of the eigenvalues. And if you do this at a classical level, which means you just pick a diagonal answer to the Lagrangian, you classically get every particles in the harmonic oscillator. But this is quantum mechanics, you have to be a little more careful. The first thing is permutation of eigenvalues is a residual gauge symmetry, because if you diagonalize the matrix in two ways, they only differ by the way the eigenvalues are shuffled. So permutation of eigenvalues is a residual gauge symmetry, which means that if you have these entry particles, they have to have some particular statistics attached to them. So they're just, not just entry particles, but entry bosons. And then there's the second problem, which is a bit more complicated, which is that when you do change of variables in quantum mechanics, like going from Euclidean coordinates to spherical coordinates or something like that, you have some changes of measure that change the way you take the Laplacian. So the Laplacian gets modified depending on your coordinate system. And we need to calculate the correct Laplacian in terms of this eigenvalue basis. Well, if you do this correctly, in the end, you're playing entry fermions in the harmonic oscillator. So let me show you a little bit how this works. First of all, your Laplacian, there's a mass term, which goes like trace of z squared. That can be written immediately in terms of the eigenvalues. So the mass term stays there. The terms in red are the terms that come from this chain of measure. And this measure can be calculated exactly. It's a very old result. And it's the square of the van der Waals determinant. So I can write it in this form. And this is not the end. You will also have to do a singularity transformation on your wave functions. So if you write your wave function in terms of the van der Waals determinant times some new wave function, it's this new wave function that you get over there, which is a free-fermion system. So you have to do some changes along the way to go from your matrix quantum mechanics to your system of fermions in the harmonic oscillator. But this is well understood. And then because you're in the harmonic oscillator and you have fermions, you can write all the wave functions. And there's a little bit of mathematical physics involved that the bases or selected determinants of your fermion wave functions coincide exactly with the character basis. Now, this is a funny quantum mechanical system. And we want to actually work in terms of the phase space, because the variable z that was showing up in this construction was really a complex variable. So it means that you want to analyze all your wave functions in some holomorphic basis. And the way you introduce holomorphic to this setup is you really go to the phase space of the system, and you work on a two-dimensional plane. But this is a phase space. So the form we see is classically a circle centered around the origin, which is the energy at which the last fermion is occupied, and it's a filled circle. And then the Fermi statistics, together with the uncertainty principle, make these fermions on phase space behave like an incompressible fluid, and you can actually be more precise about it. It really identifies this system with an integer quantum Hall effect droplet, or just fermions below the Landau level on a strong magnetic fluid. So this is where quantum fluids make their appearance. And you can write a basic dictionary between quantum Hall effect physics and BPS states. So you have your liquid system, you have edge excitations, these are the traces, and these are what we call the small gravitons, and this follows from the work on bosonization of free fermions and all this other stuff. That was when I condensed matter physics. Very long time. The giants that go into AES are what we call electrons away from the droplet, and the giants going into S are also away from the edge. So let me give you the picture. The picture is you have your droplet of fluid, you have wave deformations for the edge. These are what we call gravitons, coherent states of these give you coherent shape deformations in the droplet. And then you also have the holes and the particles. And in the gravity side, the holes were discovered before the particles. So you could try to ask what happens beyond linearized supergravity and using probe B-brains on a geometry. So we'll ask the question the following way. What objects are usually well described by supergravity? Well, non-linearly, coherent states of gravitons are what we call a classical gravity solution. So when you think of classical solutions, you're really thinking in terms of coherent states of objects. And the other types of objects that have a very good supergravity description are large stacks of coinciding D-rings. So if you put a lot of D-rings on top of each other, to the extent that that's possible, you can usually replace those D-rings by the supergravity deformation that they form. And this is part of the way the LSFT was argued. So this is suggesting that one can describe arbitrary droplet shapes, just of this quantum Hall fluid, in supergravity, because individual droplets or individual particles and holes are considered to be D-brains, and you just stuff as many D-brains on top of each other as you can, and then you deform the edges of the configurations that you get, and that's what you call a classical solution. So actually, there is a formalism that can reconstruct a complete geometry associated to any macroscopic droplet configuration. It's the work of Lindgren and Anderson. So I'm going to go a little bit about how that works, but not in all the details that they would give you. So I'm just going to tell you a construction in supergravity for analyzing half EPS geometries. And they basically exploit all the information on the supergravity side, and we're going to get a picture which is very similar to this quantum Hall picture. So the LLM construction is that you begin with supergravity solutions with a particular isometry, which is a set of unbroken symmetries, bosonic symmetries, of the state you're considering. So you can read those isometries in the field theory side, and then you just build from there. So you have an SL4 cross SL4 cross R symmetry. The two SL4s are the fact that the field Z is charged under a particular U1 charge inside SO6, and the SO4 commutant of that charge is left invariant, but we don't touch it. So that's one of the SO4s. The other SO4 is just a set of isometries on your tree sphere, and we argue that we were doing everything in the S wave on the tree sphere, so these are scalar modes independent of the position on the sphere. So that's the second S3. Then you put usual warp factors around it, you have four additional coordinates. There's an additional time translation invariance, which is associated to the BTS state equation. So that gives you an extra isometry. So that's going to take care of our time. And then you need some free metric for the other directions and some time warp factor. Now, because the system is supersymmetric, exhausting the bosonic symmetries does not exhaust all the symmetry of the system. So we need to impose the conditions of supersymmetry on these ensembles. So supersymmetry predicts a special coordinate y, which turns out to be the product of the two radii of the two spheres, roughly. And it is positive definite. And then I can write the complicated form of the solution. So everything is going to be built out of some matrix H, and some warp factor H, some vector potential. We have two transverse coordinates left over that we have not touched. They're going to have a flat metric. There's this y direction. These three coordinates are dressed by the same H function over here. There's some complicated function over here in terms of the exponential of this function G. G is related by this equation to H. So you know G, you know H. And then you introduce this function Z, which is the hyperbolic tangent of G. So you know Z, you know G, you know H. And then in terms of this function Z, you can solve for this vector potential. And then it's a pretty messy set of solutions. Never mind all this stuff. The only thing is that if you find Z, then you find the solution. And then there's some consistency equation for all this, which is a partial differential equation for Z, which you have to solve, and it's linear, so there's no much trouble solving a system like that. But we have to remember that y equals 0 is a special plot, because the y was the multiplying a radius function. So you have to be careful with this equation. You have to have boundary conditions of y equals 0. OK, here we have this function, this complicated problem. It looks like a Laplace equation with a little bit of some funny y-dependence sort of in various places. But you actually require regularity of these functions Z, or regularity of the supergravity solution, then at y equals 0, this function Z can take only two possible values, which is plus 1/2 or minus 1/2 in this notation. So when you have this type of situation, you're really getting your x1, x2 plane covered in two colors, which are the values of Z at the boundary. So you get a two coloring of the plane, which you want to identify with this droplet picture of the quantum commutator. So you also find quantization of area, which ends up being a direct quantization condition for fluxes and supergravity. So with the quantization of area, you get this two coloring of incompressible fluid type configurations. So the idea is that this seems to be very similar to what we were getting before. OK, so let me explain what happens or how you analyze one of these. You have these two coloring on the plane, so it's in purple and white. Then there's a third direction which is sticking out of the plane. And you can consider different, you can consider these three sphere vibrations which degenerate on this plane over here on the screen. And then a particular three sphere shrinks to zero size on the boundary. And then you can cap it up with some dome. And then the three sphere has finite size away from the boundary. So what you're really giving is a description of a topological phi-sphere. And this is a non-contractible topological phi-sphere. So when you have a complicated droplet configuration like this one, the topology of this picture actually translates to having different topologies in spacetime. So when you're doing AVS geometries, this is not homotopic anymore to AVS 5 process 5 in the sense that you have to change the topology to get to AVS 5 process 5. So it's not a small deformation in any sense. You really are changing topology. So you can describe these things in terms of blobs on the plane. And we don't have to describe these things in terms of these free fermions. And the free fermions also give you two-dimensional droplet pictures, which is just stacking fermions on top of each other and doing a semi-classical analysis there. So if the different topologies of the two coloring correspond to different spacetime topologies, and it is very suggestive that this fermi-liquid picture should be identified on phase space exactly as geometry on AVS 5 process 5. So I'm going to try to argue that this is the way we're supposed to think about the problem of geometry in AVS 5 process 5. You have some problem of field theory, you reduce it to eigenvalues, you try to understand what those eigenvalues are doing, there's going to be some macroscopic picture from how these eigenvalues do their stuff. And this macroscopic picture is what we are going to call geometry. And this is the program I'm going to try to outline. Now I'm going to get technical for just a little bit, which is how do we think of fermion density when you have a fermion wave function? So we have a fermion wave function, like your favorite fermion wave function, like the ground state over there. You have the slightly determinant from the ground state, and part of the event, that's the product of Zi minus Zj, that's the Mandelbrot determinant. And then you have the usual Gaussian factor, because these are fermions in the harmonic oscillator. So the question is, how do you get what we call the microscopic fermion density from a microscopic wave function of fermions? Well, there's one way to do it. It's not uniform, and not everyone will agree exactly this part. But what you do is you square the wave function and you interpret that as a probability density on your multi-fermion configurations. And then you realize that these distances between the fermion squared, you can conveniently put them in the potential or in the exponential. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to shift tactics a little bit. So P is some probability density on the space of all these fermions, and I've written it in a particularly suggestive way in terms of an exponential form of some functions, which depend on some particular coordinates. Because I've written it as an exponential, you can think of this as some type of thermodynamic ensemble. And it's a probability density, so you can think of this as a partition function for a gas of particles with which are two dimensions because we have z and z bar. And then we also have some logarithmic interactions between these particles in two dimensions. And you can actually recognize this logarithm as a Coulomb potential in two dimensions. So this is really a Coulomb gas in two dimensions. So once you have this problem, you think of it thermodynamically, you coarse grain the system, and you introduce the fermion density. So the sum over the z becomes the integral over the density of x times x squared. The sum over the logarithm becomes an integral. The density times the logarithm is the usual coarse graining approximation that we do in thermodynamic system. And on top of that, we have a constraint on the total number of fermions. So what we do now is we can find the density rho by taking a variational approach, which is just maximize this probability. And then what I'm going to try to tell you is that, well, first of all, when you do that, you get this circle and you get the right density of fermions. And you get this kind of density configuration. And this is just a result from plasma physics. But you can try to push the following interpretation. The square of the wave function that we wrote down is some type of probability density that tells you which geometry you're on, because it tells you what the configuration of fermions that you're getting is. So you want to think about that as some type of Euclidean partition function for gravity, because this wave function square has an interpretation as some statistical problem, and this is the usual thing that we get in Euclidean problems in quantum field theory. So I would like to try to push that the square of the wave function should be roughly interpreted as some partition function for gravity, but with the proviso that we are really analyzing only the half PTS sector in this problem. So it's a mini superspace wave function or partition function. And then you can also show that these coherent states of traces of the fermion representation actually produce deformations of the fermion density, which actually match exactly the supergravity deformations of the function z at the boundary when you try to quantize the problem in gravity, or when you try to write this function. So in some sense, the identification of coherent states or traces with gravitons also goes all the way through with this fermion picture included. So the idea is that you really are describing the same thing. So I'm going to stop doing half PTS physics, and I'm going to reduce the number of supersymmetries. So instead of studying states that respect half of the supersymmetries, I'm going to study states that respect only 1/8 of the supersymmetries. And this is where the physics starts getting more interesting. In the free field limit, well, the BPS bound is that the energy of the configuration is equal to the angular moment. And by using some tricks on the operator state correspondence and some other problems in field theory, you can relate these problems to the chiral ring momentum of Fourier Mills. And instead of writing everything in terms of one matrix component, you end up writing everything in terms of three matrices. And they're really complex matrices. And so what that means is that I'm only going to study holomorphic wave functions on this set of six matrices. And then the effective action that you reduce for scalars becomes this action over here. So this is the N equal 4 Jungian's action on the free sphere. You have the kinetic terms for the fields. You have some mass term, which comes from the coupling of the scalars to the to the curvature of the sphere. This is part of the conformal coupling of the scalars to the sphere. And then you get the usual Jungian's commutator square interaction. And then what you notice classically is that this commutator square term contributes to the energy but does not contribute to angular momentum. So what that means is that we have commutators different from zero. We are studying non-BPS states. And we'll actually set it to zero by hand and think of this as a BPS solution. And the effective dynamics now is a gauge matrix model, quantum mechanics, of commuting matrices. We can, because the matrices commute and the axes are Hermitian matrices, we can actually diagonalize all matrices simultaneously by gauge transformations. So we can take these eigenvalues, and to each eigenvalue we can associate a sixth vector, which is the corresponding values of the diagonal components of these matrices on the corresponding box. So we have this eigenvalue system, and to each eigenvalue position we associate a sixth vector. Again, we have a measure from going to generic commuting matrices to diagonal commuting matrices, which is gauge fixing. And you can compute that measure, and that measure ends up being something very similar to Van der Mond, except that now you have to take the differences of these six vectors squared. And this is basically an SO6 invariant way to do this volume of the gauge ordering. And again, you have your eigenvalue or your Hamiltonian, which is includes this measure term inside, and we have this derivatives over here. Okay. One of the fun things about this Hamiltonian is that, in spite of looking very complicated, you can actually find a reasonable ground state, which is just if the Gaussian wave function, you realize that this is a solution to the spectral problem of the Hamiltonian. And because the Gaussian wave function has no zeros anywhere, and it's a well-behaved function, it looks very reasonable to think of that as a ground state. And if we do the same type of singularity transformation that happened when going from the complicated eigenvalue dynamics to free fermions, we can absorb the square root of the measure in the wave functions. So we define a new wave function where you just put a new inside in front of the wave function. And you now analyze this psi hat. And then this psi zero hat, again, can be written. The square of this wave function can again be written in terms of some kind of Gaussian model with logarithmic interactions, except that now we're in six dimensions. So we are doing logarithmic interactions in six dimensions, and we want to interpret this in the same way we did the half PS states, which was reasonable because we knew that we had to describe the droplet in the half PS case that described the density of fermions. Now we're going to describe these guys over here, except that now these are not fermions anymore. And this is really absolute value, they're bosons. These are bosons in six dimensions. They're functions with interactions. You cannot get rid of the interactions anymore. So we interpret this collection of eigenvalues as positions of particles in a 6D phase space. The fact that we're in a phase space has to do with supersymmetry, and it depends on how which supersymmetries you chose to preserve. So you have n bosons in six dimensions with logarithmic repulsive interactions. And then you want to play the same thermodynamic game that we were playing with the happy PS states, which is you want to introduce a boson density and study the thermodynamics of this ensemble in a silent point approximation. Well, one of the surprises of this setup is that if you follow the rules of the game, you find that the density of bosons is not a smooth density. It actually is a singular configuration. And the singular configuration is not all the bosons at the origin, because we are repulsive interactions. But the simplest type of singular configuration that one can put together with respect to the symmetries of this ensemble is to just put all the eigenvalues at a fixed distance from the origin, and then calculate the density from them. So the density is a delta function uniformly distributed over a phi sphere of a particular radius. And this is a round S5. And you remember the ADS-CFP, we're supposed to take an equal four Yang nails on the round free sphere, and we're supposed to compare that to ADS-5 plus S5 geometry. And I'm going to try to argue that this round five sphere that we're getting over here is exactly the S5 of ADS-5 plus S5. Okay? So how do we do that? What we do is we add coherent states by taking traces of complex matrices. So you pick your favorite complex division of these objects. You just take your wave function for the ground state and you multiply it by these traces. You use the fact that these Lensons are non-renormalized to some extent to try to make the same arguments based on supersymmetry. It turns out that these coherent states keep the singular aspect of the density, but they form the shape of this phi sphere. This is another technical result. And this is very similar to what happens in gravity, because in gravity you have this S5 and you have some deformations of the S5. The tensor representations that you get here are the same that you get in gravity, because this is the result of Witten and company. What we're going to say is just this is the same thing. So this S5 is the true S5. And since we get something that looks identical in spirit on both sides, we're going to say that these two objects are the same. So this is how we extract the geometry of ADS5 plus S5. Of course, I've only extracted the S5, I haven't told you the full on ADS5. But this is the phi sphere at the origin of ADS5 ADS5 plus S5. Okay, here's something that happens. The approximations that lead to commuting matrices actually prove a strong coupling. Well, that will not be how become heavy. So this is the typical mass term that you get for the energy of these oscillators, and let me remind you what the action is. So the action of the scalars involve these commutator squared p times the Yang-Mills squared. The radius of this phi sphere is of order square root of n. So when you take the proof coupling to be large from these commutator squared p term, you can calculate an effective mass term for the off-diagonal modes. And you find that the energy of these oscillators is roughly this one. Okay? So, because, and where these are eigenvalues, xj minus xj prime. So, since these eigenvalues actually turn out to be of order square root of n, then the energy of these off diagonal modes becomes very heavy and you can really integrate them out systematically. So, this reduction to eigenvalues is something that improves at the level of effective field theory when you go to strong coupling. So this means that the dynamics that we have discussed so far seems to improve as you go towards strong coupling. So the fact that you have this phi sphere with geometry fluctuating around it seems to be the correct low energy description of the strong coupling physics. And this is what we're supposed to identify with gravity. So we're finding exactly the right type of situation. Yes?
In the one matrix example, you identify the phase space with the two coordinates in the geometry
symbol,
right?
Yeah, well,
you
identify the axis with the S5, because all the axes are in a particular radius.
And that you got by computing this density.
Yeah.
So one of the phase space.
Well, it is some kind of phase space, but the fact that it's a phase space is something that has to do with choosing a particular subset of supersymmetries to preserve. If you forget that for a second, then it's a regular X representation of the wave function. And then we're not doing anything much. Yes?
May I be able to ask a naive question?
Yeah.
You see, you identify this with gravity. So we know of what we know about gravity observation, we know it's all gravity.
Yes.
We know GR's current in the system. So can you calculate, say, the gradient of our spark?
This will be supergravity in tandem metrics. Huh? This will be supergravity on ADS-5 process 5.
Oh, you should be able to get the four.
Well, I still haven't argued that the gravitational interactions are reproduced. I just argued that the supersymmetric gravity configurations are reproduced. I haven't derived Newton's law yet.
You what?
I have not derived Newton's law yet. Well, the statement is we have this collection of wave functions, and we can identify with particular classical solutions that respect some number of solutions. And because we get the same type of shape from both sides, we can do the identification. But that's not to say that we have reproduced the gravitational interactions.
We need to get one of R squared.
Yes. I agree completely. this is not there yet. This is the idea is how gravity shows up. I haven't told you all the details of that. I'm just trying to make a case for saying that this is the way gravity shows up and just do a lot of work to be done. Like making sure that we reproduce gravitational interactions. But the fact that we get some nonlinear aspects of gravity correctly in the superspace approximation tells you that you're probably doing the right thing.
The other question I have is you have to create a supersymmetry because gravity is low energy. It's an infrared phenomenon.
Yeah, but in this particular case, AVS 5 plus S5, it is a supersymmetric configuration, so what you're really supposed to get is supergravity on this. Eventually, yes, you have to get.
You have to create
supersymmetry. Yeah, what we're using here is supersymmetric supergravity in 10 dimensions on a particular supersymmetric microwave. Yeah. And some of those. But here you get results here. What I'm trying to claim is that this dynamical reduction to eigenvalues improves as you go towards strong coupling because the orthogonal nodes become very heavy. They become, the energy associated to them becomes large. So you can take a systematic decoupling limit by going to low energies and get rid of all these things. Now, if you want to do that forever, not really. We're going to suggest that this is actually the origin of the string scale in AVS 5 plus S5. Because we're not just supposed to be matching to supergravity, we're really supposed to be matching to type 2D string theory on AVS 5 plus S5. So we also have to argue that strings are moving on this geometry. So I'm going to make a suggestion of how you recover strings. Well, strings are heavy. Long strings, they weigh a lot. The string tension for long distances contributes the energy of all. So I'm going to suggest that these all angle nodes in this eigenvalue object are massive and that they give rise to the string scale. So how can that happen? Well, since these all diagonal nodes connect two eigenvalues within a particular diagonalization of the matrices, then you can actually draw a segment between the two corresponding eigenvalues and just paint it in this column. And when you take care of gauge invariance and the other stuff, you can think of these things as really string bits that you just couple together and you make closed loops. And this is just Gauss's law. And then on top of that, you need to dress them with gravity, which I call the eigenvalues. So the ends are going to be dressed up by gravity somehow. So this is a sketch. This is supposed to look pretty and remind you of a string, although this looks like a polygonal string. The point is that I'm going for strong coupling. You can argue that long distances on the sphere cost you lots of energy because the energy formula that I wrote before depends on the distances between the eigenvalues, and the bigger the distance, the more the energy. So the configurations with little energy are the ones that correspond to small segments. And you connect a lot of small segments together, they can have roughly the same energy as these long polygonal ones. And then if all of these states mix, and they probably do, then you can argue that the ones that have the most number of states will dominate. And these are the ones with a lot of little string bits around. So it starts to look like a single model for the string. This is supposed to be a cartoon of what's really happening. But the idea is that somehow you're getting something that looks like strings, and you can try to verify the string tension. So let me do that. What we do is we can calculate the radius of the sphere exactly. This depends on solving that problem of the eigenvalues and being careful about the delta function and minimizing the energy and so on. And then the radius is square root of n over 2, independent of how many matrices you have, so long as you have enough matrices. So except for one or two matrices, the size is really independent of the number of matrices. So we can normalize the radius. It's not that this radius is an uncalculable quantity, it's actually calculable. And given the radius, we can calculate the energies of these off diagonal nodes exactly. So one can try to calculate some string energies which are known exactly in this geometry. So now I'm going to work part of the technical know-how from ADS 5 process 5. If you've been around in the last few years, there's this thing called DMN limit and DMN states, which I helped put together. And basically, the idea is to consider states which are traces with some faces inside them. And I'm going to write it in this particular form with commutators, y commutators in and x commutators in. And the point is that this state is produces something where commutators are turned on. Because if y and z commute, then the state vanishes, obviously, because the commutator of y and z is. So when I write a state like this, I can do an approximation. There's a large j number of the z's. So I'm going to assume that the z's are to be treated as diagonal nodes. And I'm going to assume that these other two guys over here are off diagonal nodes. And we're going to assume furthermore that the off diagonal nodes, for the time being, are treated as free fields. It's just an approximation to see how well they're doing physics. And then you can calculate the DMN state, assuming that the off diagonal nodes don't affect the diagonal ones the first order. So this is some type of Born-Oppenheimer approximation. There's a lot of approximations that you do. And then, in the end, the calculation of energies can be done in a solid point approximation. And then, the point is that you're summing over all possible positions of these eigenvalues, but in this limit, the result localizes on two particular eigenvalues, which are a great circle of ES5, who are separated by an angle to theta, where theta is related to k or to j. And then the expected value of the energy of these oscillators is very sharply peaked around the saddle, which suggests that you are getting something which is close to an eigenstate of the Hamilton domain. And then what you get is this formula over here, which is just calculating the mass of these off diagonal nodes, multiplying it by 2, and taking into account the energy of the diagonal bits. Now, the amazing thing is that when you do this, you actually match the DMN string calculation to all orders in the truth coupling exactly. So this particular formula you get here with d and n squared a, and you have to take this sine squared function in the limit where you take j large and k fixed. So it's the limit where the theta is approximately equal to the sine of theta. And what that does is that it makes the RNG eigenvalues very close to each other, and this segment becomes a tangent segment of the sphere. And this actually, surprisingly, after all the approximations and all the hacking we've done on this problem, actually you reproduce this formula with all the coefficients exactly. And this g squared n over here depends very precisely on calculating the radius of the distribution correctly. If you change the radius of the distribution, you change that coefficient. But the coefficient came out right, and this is supposed to be the strong coupling result in this limit, because you can reproduce those energies using string calculation. Well, are we doing great? Not exactly. You cannot rematch a string sigma model by assuming that these off-diagonal modes are free. The reason is obvious. Geometrically, then you're calculating the gradient distance between I and j of this sphere embedded on a six-dimensional flat space. Whereas if you were doing a string calculation with a string tangent to the sphere, you would be calculating the angle, but not this chord length between eigenvalues and j. So what this means is that this approximation of free string bits is naive, but it's not naive in the DMN limit. So if the string bits are short, they can be treated as free fields, roughly. If they're long, they can't. They're going to mix with a lot of other stuff. So there's something going on here that suggests that for some questions, treating the orthogonal modes as free is a good approximation. So the point is that after you do all of these and you get something that you have no right to expect, you know that something of what you did is actually correct. We do all those approximations in order to be able to do any calculation. No? And after we've done them, you actually find something, you're reproducing something that that we know from the string side is the correct strong coupling calculation. Now, I also told you that the calculations, in some sense, technical sense, improve with strong coupling. So here we see that we don't just reproduce the first order perturbation theory, but we do a lot better than that. So you can ask, what did we do? Well, this is, if you want to do final diagrams, it's very hard to get this complete perturbation formula because it's to all orders of perturbation theory. And the final diagrams at sufficiently high order, it becomes really hard. So this is something which takes care of some of these summation over diagrams and does it very nicely for you. And it seems to be correct. So this is it. I'm going to tell you why I think this is so great. We have a new understanding of how ideas CFP works out. So I was doing mostly CFP and then I was occasionally borrowing from gravity to match things, and I was getting a very nice intuitive match between what we call geometry on ADS and what we call this emergent geometry from the CFT based on thermodynamics, force graining, all this other stuff. The slogan is that gravity appears as hydrodynamics in some sense. Think of hydrodynamics as collective phenomena. You have a lot of eigenvalues. And it's really the collective deformations of these eigenvalue distributions that you're after. And you can also address some amount of locality because you have BS5, you take a point of BS5, you know what that means in the field theory. So you're addressing the issue of at least semi-classical gravity and local probes of the geometry. There's some amount of background independence, at least for these happy PS solutions. You can have many topologies in the same field theory and you can do transitions between them. And you can analyze it to a great degree of certainty. And you know that on both sides you can reproduce the same qualitative picture. So the technical statement is that if you look at these BPS configurations, where we have a mini superspace version of background independence, where you're just taking care of the supersymmetric configurations with the right asymptotic behavior. Moreover, I gave you a picture of the origin of strings. The picture is not just a pretty picture, but that is actually a tool where you can actually calculate some strong BPS energy, and you reproduce exactly the results of strong coupling based on string techniques. So in some sense, this picture tells you that this is it, because you're doing a very efficient calculation of all of these energies. And you seem to be getting the right geometrical picture in the end. So, of course, when you have all this good stuff, you have a lot of questions, and you have many leads to follow, trying to make sense of it all, and try to put together the rest of the pieces of the puzzle to see if this is the right way to think about geometry. Thank you.
Good questions?
So, I mean, it's quite reasonable to expect that if you localize something, so for the thing that you have been looking at, it's essentially sit at the center of ADS.
Yeah.
It's reasonable to expect that the truncation of the gate theory to the S wave, because you're looking at sort of some infrared limit of the gate theory. But so, again, the question is, do you have some intuition of how you localize things in ADS?
Yes. You localize them on the origin, and then you move them by the S wave. It's not a useful view.
From the gate theory point of view.
From the gate theory point of view, we know that the isometries act on the Hilbert space of states because we know how to exponentiate the generators. But other than that, I don't really know how to do it in a more precise sense. It would be nice to be able to have something at the origin and something elsewhere. I don't know how to do it yet. But I do know how to put something at the origin elsewhere in here.
No, I mean, from the geometry point of view, it's obvious point of view, but right. From the Gateson point of view, it involves physics at different scales. And,
yeah, so you have to exponentiate. You have to exponentiate the super conformal generators, and that will renormalize your scales appropriately, right? Because the conformal generators change the way. Yeah. So that's one way to do it. It's not ideal. I cannot really claim yet that I have the full understanding of the full AES5 process of geometry. But the S5 was in some sense very evident in this whole process, and we now see the S5. And you also have the S3 and are at the boundary. So you put it together, you have 9 out of 10 directions. And the only one that you really need to work hard is the radial direction.
That's a difficult one.
Well, in some sense, it should be the one related to the fact that the droplet is sitting at some finite distance on this 6th plane, and then there's the outside of the droplet. And this, in some sense, is supposed to be the radial direction somehow, because that's what happened in the half EPS case. But I don't know how to make it better than that yet.
So a couple of questions. First, this means that you can't talk about black holes or horizons or curvature singularities.
Yes, you can. Since you have some notion of locality, you can try to put a lot of energy in one little spot and sort of let it do whatever it does. And putting a lot of energy here is not just exciting the eigenvalues, but turning on all of these orthogonal modes.
The second question is, if you have all these topologies, and if you're talking about the center of the ADS, there are no isometries there for you to push anything out with an isometry.
Right.
So how do you talk about pushing things out and having all these non-trivial topologies? I don't have isometries.
Well, for the half-EPS solutions, we do have this matching between the Fermi description and the gravity description. And the idea is that because the two pictures look so tantalizingly equal to each other, you just make them that way. Then the main problem is how do you put excitations which are not on the edges of these droplets? And this is the hard part. It's not that you cannot identify the geometries, that to solve that problem is in some sense the same problem that Jana was talking about. How do you talk about locality away from the origin?
So how can you pin down what topologies you're talking about?
Well, in this case, it's because the Fermi droplet in the thermodynamic limit has some very particular density, and that determines the topology of the configuration.
The topology of the manifold?
It determines the topology of the manifold, because the different topologies correspond to different number of different Bell numbers of
the manifold. So what specific topologies can you describe? Can you say what they are?
Two, two, three,
what are they?
Well, in the half EPS case, there are these topologies with a whole bunch of S5s. In the quarter and 1/8 EPS, it gets a little bit more hairy. There's no classification yet of all the topologies that you can. It's not clear what the full picture of all of this is. When I said background independence, I didn't mean that I had full background independence, but some moderate amount of it in the sense of all these supersymmetric solutions being having different topologies and that being included as part of the description. I mean, of course, we all want stronger than that, but this is the state of the art at the moment. I'm sorry that I cannot.
I'm just addressing your talk,
This is just a statement that we have these topologies with a whole bunch of non-contractable five spheres. And it's just that. So you have topologies which are broadly based on some four-dimensional base with five-dimensional cycles. Yes?
I would have thought that any approach to showing ADS UFD or proving the conjecture would have had something to do with open spring and closed spring duality. And do you see any connection here?
Well, this is in some sense that connection. I'd like to give a very long answer to that question. When you look at the sequels one matrix model, the sequels one matrix model is also, in the matrix model description, it's like the open string version. And when you go to eigenvalues and their distributions and their dynamics, this is actually the closed string version. Here, the open string version is this super Young-Mills matrix system, and the closed string version is this eigenvalue distributions have plus constraint point. So there's a little bit of that. But it's not like you have a full open string theory, and then you do open closed string duality, and you get a full closed string.
Any more questions? This is a slide of hand. The statement is that when you count the states, it is having, it's like having one permission matrix oscillator. But you write it in terms of x plus ip, which is a complex.
Okay.
So it's that statement that in second order dynamics is one permission operator, in first order dynamics it's a complex operator. Okay? So this is this is one of those things that if I really went into the details, I would spend the whole lecture.
No, in fact, I didn't ask anything because I was.